And I have to stay over here.
You have to stay. Okay, so welcome everybody. And I would like to greet Robert Feidenhans in Wigner Institute, and he will give our seminar today, the Wigner Colloquium. And Robert Feidenhans, short biography, I would like to read, received his master's degree in physics in 1983 and his PhD in 86 in University Aarhus. He worked as a staff scientist in the physics department at RISO National Laboratory from 86 to 2001, where he became the head of the materials department. And in 2005, he became professor at Niels Bohr Institute at University of Copenhagen, where he was vice institute leader from 7 to 12 and head of the institute from 12 to 17. January 2017, he became managing director of the European X-FEL in Hamburg. Robert Feidenhans has been working in the field of X-ray, synchrotron radiation, and free electron laser nearly all his career, and has also been chairman of council at the European X-ray Radiation Facility in Grenoble, and also at European X-FEL. He has been a member of the council at the European Spallation Source in Lund, Sweden. He is a co-author of about 200 publications and has an H in the index of 45. And in this year, January, he became the chair of the board of the Synchrotron Radiation Facility MAX 4 at Lund University. At the time, he also became the member of the curatorium, the Joachim Herz Foundation, located in Hamburg. Yeah. So, welcome again, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for this nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. This is actually my first time here at the Wigner Institute, although I have had several collaborators during my career. I just learned today here that there are at least a couple of people here who I worked or were at the same institute at RISO National Laboratory many, many years ago, because I actually also did a few neutron experiments. So I grew up in a nuclear, in a background of neutron and X-ray scattering. And I also had the pleasure, you mentioned, I was chair of the council at ESRF, and I had the pleasure, and I forgot whether it was 2006 or 2009, to sign the papers when Central Sync, including Hungary, actually joined the ESRF. I think that was a big moment. I understand there are some difficulties now, but I think that was a very important step. And also happy to see Dennis here, who I have seen many times every year until 3 years ago, where you left the X-FEL Council. So I'm pleased here to give you an overview on the science we do at in Hamburg, and I give you some examples. To my pleasure, I saw there's a plasma physics department here, correct? And there's a lot of plasma physics we just started to do, and I think there's a new area actually opening. I will give a few examples. So here's the layout. You see, first of all, European X-FEL, we collect a lot of data. So this is shown by this detector. I'll actually come back to that. Here's the layout of the facility. And here is actually the photo from the inauguration of European X-FEL, where we started to operate 1st of September 2017, half a year after I started. And we had here the green laser connecting the Elbphil Harmonie, sort of a lighthouse for culture with the lighthouse of science at European X-FEL. So it connected here with a distance about 13 kilometer, the two highlights, the two lighthouses with the green laser. So I will talk about a little bit about the basic principles and what the main message is, what is actually the difference between X-ray lasers and synchrotron radiation. And then I will give you some basic how the experiments are done and show some examples. Just to show you this slide here, because UP Next role is to study dynamics of matter in various circumstances. Most of the stuff is we actually study dynamic phenomena. And here are some of the dynamic phenomena shown with atomic motions, electronic transitions, and tension folding, etc. And on the larger time scales, you would then use a synchrotron to actually study these phenomena. But if you want to store the real short time scales, you have to use, or if you want to structure on real short time scales, you have to use free X-ray lasers because the pulses are very short. And this is the what I want to show with this slide here is sort of the take-home message. What is a free X-ray laser? What does it actually deliver? It delivers X-ray pulses, which are very intense and very short. So you have here a slide from, here's a synchrotron facility. Many of you might know it in Hamburg, the Dohs facility that delivers pulses which have 10 to the 9 photons at 10 kV with a duration of about 100 picoseconds. Now, a free X-ray laser delivers pulses which are maybe a couple of femtoseconds, 10 femtoseconds long, and contain 3 to 4 orders of magnitude more photons in this very short time duration. So you can see power delivered is much, much, much higher than it is at a synchrotron. So the pulse energy, if you calculate, you know, what does that actually, 10 to the 13 photons, 10 kV, is millijoule. So we deliver a millijoule, typically a millijoule of energy into the sample at every pulse. And this is sufficient for single shot experiments. So normally, if you want to do a powder diffraction or whatever, you collect for some time to collect sufficient data. Here, one pulse is enough to collect data to analyze. I think a couple of weeks ago, we saw the first Mössbauer experiment where they could get data enough with one pulse to actually look at the Mössbauer spectrum. So that is so dynamics and short time structures is really, really important here. So how does it actually work? And here's a textbook example, some very basic principles on how does a X-ray field laser. Well, what's the setup of X-ray field laser? It doesn't show how it works. I'll come back to that. So a synchrotron facility, you have electrons going around in a circle. You use them again and again and again and again. Here you have a long device where you have a linear accelerator where you accelerate the electrons up to a certain energy, in our case, 17 GeV. You have a picosecond laser, the photocathode to extract electrons, and you put them into the first linear. You have a bunch compressor where you compress the electron bunch so that the duration is only 10 femtoseconds or so. And then you have another linear accelerator to accelerate the electrons up. And then you have an undulator where the electrons go in with a sinusoidal path and emit light. And then you have a very strong X-ray beam coming out there, and then you throw all the electrons away. So you only use the electron once. So that's a very expensive way of producing X-ray, and this here, the beam dump here has to take a lot of power. So here's the general layout of the facility. You have here in the DC in Hamburg, the synchrotron racing facility. DAISY is sort of the laboratory for accelerated physics. They are really experts. And then we have, this is the state of Hamburg. And over here we have UP Nexfeld, the headquarters, where we have the experimental hall, and that's in the state of Schleswig-Holstein. So we have here a distance of about 3.5 kilometers from here to here, and it's all underground. So it's a tunnel that was drilled in the early 2010s, all the way underneath all these houses here, and everything went extremely well. So the electron injector is over here. So that's where the electrons are born. And then we go through the tunnel here. Forgot to mention about 20 meters below ground. Here's the picture of the of the tunnel. It's, you know, like a metro station in diameter. I believe the drilling machines had the sort of the same diameter. So it's a linear accelerator, as I said. It's superconducting. So the whole, this case, 2 kilometers of accelerator is cooled down to 2 Kelvin, was cooled down 2000 and end of 2016, was down at 2 Kelvin beginning in January 17, and has been there ever since without any problem. And this is can then accelerate the electrons up to 17.5 GeV. Here's the undulator system I was talking about. These are the undulators. It's in 30 sections, each 5 meters. So we have an undulator which is 150 meters long. So it's really, really a big scale equipment here. And the best of all, it really works. It really works. It worked day one when we turned on the accelerator in May 2017. We could start the user program in September 2017. So Daisy did a fantastic job here. And here's in the experimental hall in Schinefeld, where the experiments are actually being conducted. You see, we have 5 tunnels, where 3 of these tunnels are equipped with instrumentation. I have actually once been driving from here to here with a bike. So it's actually a very nice connection. You can actually drive through the tunnels with a bike. Normally only in winter time, because that's where you have a longer maintenance periods. But it's really an experience to go there as a physicist and see so much equipment that is actually connected there. You also see here at Ostover Born, he has a kicker, so you can kick some of the electrons to run in different directions. So you equip these 2 tunnels here, and there's another kicker, so you can put it into the 3 undulators that are radiating at the moment. And here's then the picture of the photon beamlines, where you look from the instruments towards source. The photon beamlines, the X-rays, are born about nearly 1 kilometer away from the experiment, so you can see the coherence will be really high if you have a traveling path of 1 kilometer. Here are the 2 tunnels, the two transport lines, because at each source, we can deliver beams to 2 different instruments and 2 guided through these 2 different transport sections via a mirror. How is European X-ray compared to other free electron lasers? Because this was not the first free electron laser built. The first one was at Stanford, started to operate in 2009, about 10 years earlier. There's a Japanese one. There's a one in Switzerland, but basically started at the same time as us. And there's a Korean one here. All these accelerators use what we call warm technology. So the accelerator is at room temperature. And there, the superconducting technology, which is sort of what Daisy Wheel Masters allow us to get many, many more pulses, because you see here, they can deliver 60 of these high intense pulses per second. They can go up to 120, they have about 100. And we can go much, much higher, which you can see here. We have a special pulse system that we are not in continuous wave. I'll show that on the next slide. But we deliver 2,700 pulses 10 times a second. So we call it the burst mode, because photons come in bursts, then nothing happens, then burst, and then nothing happens. So you can see within 600 microseconds, you get pulses, then there's nearly 100 milliseconds where nothing happens, and then it comes again. So there's a development now going on at various facilities that for some experiments, you really want to have a CW mode of operation, like at a synchrotron, where you have pulses coming in all the time with a distance of maybe for microseconds. And this is an operation mode they are just starting to commissioning at the upgrade of the LCLS in Stanford, and also what the Chinese are building in Shanghai. So we are the only ones who have this burst mode of operation, which sort of is a reminiscence of particle physics, the way the accelerator was originally constructed, where we have these pulses coming in 600 microseconds and nothing, and then 600 microseconds. But this year, we have a very high rep rate compared to the existing, apart from CW, for compared to the existing facilities, and we can actually reach a higher photon energy because we have this special mode of operation. We can go up to 25 kV, which none of the others are really capable of today. So how does the X-ray fringe laser work? It's a principle that goes back to Saldin, who did the first theoretical predictions in Novosibirsk back in the end of the 70s, and then it was later independently developed by Pellegrini and collaborators. But the basic principle is that you have an electron beam entering an undulator, and when you then enter the undulator, the electron beam will start to undulate. This is a magnetic, periodic magnetic device, and it will undulate and will start to radiate. Every time the electrons are being accelerated, they radiate, and then this radiation gets stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And remember, the pulse is very short. It gets so strong that it starts to interact on the pulse. So it's the pulse, the electron pulse coming in at the beginning was uniform. Then you see you start to make a microstructure here with the where this distance here is the wavelengths of the radiation. And then at the very end, all the electrons, or many of the electrons, are then aligned in this periodic fashion. That means that electrons deliver light not proportional to the number of electrons, but proportional to the number of electrons squared, because they act coherently, and you get a very strong photon beam coming out here. It's called self-amplified spontaneous emission because it's starting up from noise. It's basically, there's no seeding here, as you know from laser work. There's no seeding here, so it's starting up from noise. It has the disadvantage that the pulse is different from pulse to pulse. So here's a small movie made some years ago with a spectrometer where you can see here one pulse after the other, and you can see the photon energy. Okay, good. So the so you can see here the photon energy is not very well defined. So the longitudinal coherence is actually very, very small. The transverse is it's much bigger. That means that you, when you design your experiment, you really have to deal with how to actually deal with this pulse-to-pulse noise, whether you deliver it out by statistics, whether you normalize by the pulse structure, whether you use some clever new algorithm techniques to actually do the data analysis. So here's the experimental hall. And as I said, we had three undulators. These 150 meter long devices, SARS-1, SARS-2, and SARS-3, self-amplified spontaneous emission. And then for each of these tunnels, we have two instruments. I'll come back to that. Two instruments here, two instruments there. And then we have two empty tunnels. When European X-FIL was built, it was foreseen we should have 10 instruments. Dennis might remember that because then there was not sufficient amount of money, and then we said, okay, we go from 10 to 6, and then we build the other force a little bit later. So these are still empty, and we're discussing whether we should or how to fill them in maybe end of the decade. So here are the experimental hall, and typically the distance between the SARS and the instrument is, as I said, close to a kilometer. So it's a quite some distance where you then put objects to focus or bend the beam. And we are opening here on SARS-3, where we have a port, an open port. I will show a picture of that later, where users can bring their own experiment to do soft X-ray, use the softer X-ray from maybe 1 to 3 kV. And this is in commissioning, where we will do some time-resolved photon emission spectroscopy in during the next couple of weeks. So how do we actually deliver beam to these three instruments? And that is, I'm always impressed, you know, I'm a solid state physicist, but I'm always impressed what the accelerator people can do. So here we have made this small movie here, where you have 2,700 pulses coming. You have a distribution kicker system. You have a SARS-1, a SARS-3, and a SARS-2. And then every Friday, we sit and discuss what are the user experiments for next week. And then we see, I need so and so many pulses. I need so and so many. I need this duration, et cetera. And then you tell them to the accelerated people, and then they try to do the best. So you start by having a fast kicker to have a dump here to stabilize the beam. And then you can put in the electron beam here. You can see it now goes through SARS-1. And then you give it a small kick, so it doesn't lace in SARS-1. It only laces in SARS-3. And then you can have others here where you put them into SARS-1, and then it laces here, but doesn't lace on SARS-3. So you just give it a small kick, and oops, and some of the beam should, is something missing? Ah, and here are the ones going to SARS-2. So we can see maybe the first pulses here go to SARS-3, the second go to SARS-1, and then the rest of the pulse goes to SARS-2. We can also do interleave, that one go to right, one go to the left, etc. And remember, there's 200 nanoseconds in between, so it's actually amazing how well it works, and they are really really good in running the accelerator now. A little bit about the politics and the construction. Since I'm a director, I have to tell you a little bit about how the whole thing is organized. So we are 12 shareholder countries. Our task is to construct it, it's done, operate, but also further develop the electron laser. You can see some of the I will not say the important shareholders, but you have the big ones, Germany, and then of course the elephant in the room, Russia, with 27%. Russia is participating with 27%. They paid last year 40 million euros, although we don't give them access to the facility because we are the European sanctions forbid us that scientists from Russian institutes can come and do experiment at our facility, and we're still waiting whether they pay for this year or not, and then we will have a discussion with the other 11 shareholders if Russia doesn't pay. But maybe that's for the discussion afterwards. Denmark is in with 1%, Hungary is in with 1%, and the other shareholders typically 1-3%. I think Italy is free, France is free, UK too. So the bigger countries actually decided that time and time not to go in. We are about 500 people working at the Schönefeld campus. We have only one Hungarian, and that is a big mistake. I think there's lots of opportunities. So maybe we should send our job ads here to the WIG Institute and to universities, because I think we could have more Hungarians. We have a DAISY, there are about 200-250 people actually running the accelerator for us. And you can also see it's the running costs are immense, 140 million a year. So it's a huge running cost. We do 100 experiments per year typically. So each experiment costs the European taxpayer 1.4 billion euros. We need to increase the number of experiments. The scientific use of Hungary is we have a special algorithm to calculate how much scientific use is going to Hungary. It's very similar to how you do it with the ESF. And here it's about 1%, as it should be. And at the moment, we have 15 active users from Hungarian institutes, many from the Victor Institute, who are participating in experiments at European Expo. So this was the pulse structure, and a little bit about how we do the experiment, because this is, as I said, a very intense pulse. And here's what happens if you focus this very strong beam on a piece of metal, namely you drill a hole. So here's a piece of steel, and you drill, physically drill a hole through the steel micron, about 10 microns in less than half a minute. So radiation safety is something we have to take serious, and there are various tricks that this cannot happen. But this is only where the beam is focused. If it's defocused, it doesn't happen. When in a focused beam, you simply drill a hole. What happens is that the electron beam comes in, the photon beam comes in, being absorbed. And when it's absorbed, you create energy. And because there's so much energy, you create a plasma and the material evaporates. So lead is not very good at stopping the beam because it absorbs so much that the medium makes a plasma. The best is actually light elements like carbon or diamond or B4C, because the light elements, you spread out the absorption over a longer volume, and then it lasts longer. This also means that you, if you put your sample into the beam, and now think you have a neutron scattering experiment today, Lars. I suppose people come with one sample, then they look at this sample for a week or something like that. You're very careful about this. Give it years, yeah. This doesn't work with the X-fill, because if you put the sample in the beam, it explodes. In many, if you focus, it explodes. So here is a simulation on what happens. This was actually Janos Haidu, who was originally Hungarian, who did this together with others in this study where they did a simulation 20 years ago, where you say, what happens if you put a protein crystal into the beam? Then you can see when the beam hits at T equals zero, 10 femtoseconds after, the protein starts to fall apart, and here it's really analyzed. So the sample explodes. So the question is, can you do an experiment where you collect data before the sample explodes, and you see within the first 10 femtoseconds, you can collect the data there, the sample is untouched. And here's the proof of principle experiment done at a smaller X-ray field tunnel laser flash, also in Hamburg, where they took a sample. Here's a sample of two men and a son. You put it into the beam, and then you look at the scattering from this sample. This is a scattering image from this sample. And then via clever algorithms, you can then reconstruct the sample from this picture here. And this is actually the reconstruction. You can see this is SEM picture, and this is the reconstruction of this image. So if you could actually take, this demonstrate that you could take the image before the sample was destroyed. This is the sample after you have hit it with the beam, because whole sample is destroyed and gone. This is shot number two, where you only see the streaks from the edges of the of the sample. But the proof of principle that you can diffract before destroy was shown here, and that's really, really important for many of the experiments. So here's the experimental hall again, and I think the next one I will show some of the some of the instruments that were taken in use. We had the first two instruments. We started, we were very courageous because the beam was in May. We started user experiments in September. And George can confirm that a lot of things actually did not work for the first experiments. There were actually more things that probably did not work than things that worked. But nevertheless, we started user operation and slowly it went on. Two instruments in September 17, two in November 18, and two in 19, and then March 20, we had Corona. So we were actually, we had a bit of a rough start, but nevertheless, we started to go. We had the recently a 5 years of user operation where we celebrate the 5 years. And I always repeat this. We were built on time, built on budget, and we have now shown that we can operate in 5 years. And I say that because there are other facilities in Europe which do not do that. I mean, you're a member of another facility up there in Sweden, where it takes a long time. So we are very proud of that we can actually celebrate successfully 5 years of user operation. So what kind of science do we then do? I will only show flashes of some of the scientific experiments that is being done. So here are the six, not the seven, the six instrument with the group leaders and the name. And we have this one here, SPP-SFX, is mainly for biology, but we are now looking into material science where we look at nanoparticles. I will show some new examples from the high energy density of state, which is really exciting work coming out for materials under high pressure, plasma physics, etc. We have this here, spectroscopy and coherent scattering, which actually has done a lot of magnetic work. So we have a very strong magnetic program. We have the femtosecond experiments here. We have a lot of users from the Wigner Institute, where we looked at dynamics of liquids and solid matters. We have the materials imaging and dynamics, and we have the more basic small quantum system set up here at SARS-3. So I'll come back to the many of the experiments, not all, but many of the experiments are done in a radically different way than we do at a neutron experiment, because here you have not one sample, but you have millions of samples. So we have a jet of small crystals. This is a cartoon from Peter Frommer, how they do experiment on SPP. So you have many, many small crystals. We can basically think of that you take a powder and then you separate the powder in many, many small crystals and then look at the crystals one by one. And then you have the X-ray beam coming here. This is the pulse train where you have maybe 2,700 pulses. It hits this stream of particles. And if you're lucky, it actually gives a diffraction signal, because it's in one pulse is enough to give a full diffraction picture that you can then analyze. But there are probably crystallographers around you. The crystals are not oriented, so it's a random orientation. You have to sort out the orientation of the crystal afterwards, but if you have enough data, you can actually do that. So typically you collect maybe 100,000 scattering images, maybe a million, depends a little bit on how the good experiment is going. And the hit rate, by the way, is only that if you're lucky, then 10% of the pulses hit. And then you have, or if you're unlucky, it's only 1%. So here's how it works. It's one of the first publications. You have the jet here, and then you it's taken with an ultra fast camera, and then we can see. So here's the jet unperturbed, first pulse, second pulse, third pulse, etc. So you can see every time the pulse hit the jet, it explodes. But you can take the paper showed that you can take the scattering images, convert it, and get the crystal structure. And you get a very good crystal structure, because basically you take the picture before radiation damage actually set in. So you get better crystal structures than you do normally with protein crystallography. So if you want to make molecular movies, which we often want to do, here's the setup. You then have proteins come into the beam, you do diffraction images, and then you do pump probe. Many of our experiments do pump probe. We have a very versatile pump setup where you have the protein crystal come in with an optical laser to pump the sample, and then you come with a certain time delay afterwards and look at the structure of the sample at this time delay after you actually pumped it. Then you have maybe 8 or 10 different time delays, and then you have can measure the structure and in principle make a molecular movie. This here is a simulation from earlier days, but some of the experiment, here's one of the first experiments where people used our data here, where you look at the photoactive site here and the photoactive yellow protein, where you can sort of see what happens structurally as a function of time after you have absorbed the photon. 3 picoseconds, 200 picoseconds. These here were the X-fill data. This is what's done at the LCLS, and this here was Singleton data. So you can actually do this kind of molecular movies. And this is again the scattering setup. You have a focused beam, hit the sample. You have a jet. You have the pump laser coming in here, and then you collect really, really many images, and then you do the data analysis. And there's a whole set of various techniques in how to analyze these data. And today we know typically after you have done an experiment, after 10, 15 minutes, whether you have good data or not. In the beginning, it took much more longer. Because these are the detectors. Yesterday, I was asked how the detectors actually work. And so I will show this slide here. This is the scattering detector of one of our detectors, the ATIP detector on SPP. This is the, it's based on silicon. So we have these four segments here. And we take one image for one pulse. And on this, and then this, you know, the pulse come after 200 nanoseconds. So you cannot read off the detector between the pulses. So what you do here is that you have here, you collect for this first train here, you can collect up to 352 frames, and then you read them out in this dark period. So we, in principle, we could collect 3,520 frames per second with this detector. And some of the experiments we do create a tremendous amount of data. So we have had experiments here which collect 1 to 2 petabyte of data. We, you know, collecting the raw data, we are collecting data of the same, nearly the same amount of CERN. And we're now working in how to reduce the amount of data we're actually collecting, because all the empty frames, we could, if we knew where they were, we could take them away. So we have a very high complexity of experiments. We have the diagnostics of the pulses coming in. We have the optics to focus a beam. We have the optical lasers to pump the sample. We have the big detectors which need to be calibrated, and that all that actually works extremely well. We have the sample delivery with these jets. That's a little bit more tricky. There's still some clocking going on. And then we have the data analysis where we have the immense amount of data that needs to be analyzed. I'll give you one example of a very nice experiment which I really like a lot. And this was one of the first experiments on the MID instrument, and this was on water. And we actually do a lot of different experiments now on water. This was the first. We had a special call for water. I think we had done 8 to 10 experiments now. They were analyzed last week. But here was how a water bubble is actually created. A very fundamental question: how does it actually work? Cavitation. And here they had a liquid, a capillary with water. Then you create water bubbles with an optical laser. So a laser comes, a water bubble arises. You cannot really control when exactly how it and how it works. But if you create the water bubbles, you then focus the X-ray beam at a point before the sample. Then you basically make a hologram of the sample. Then you look at water bubbles like this. This is a hologram of the water bubble, which you then can, via the new algorithms, you can actually come back and calculate what is the structure of the water bubble. And then you can look before, after 5 nanoseconds, 9 nanoseconds, 50 nanoseconds, and then see how does the water bubble actually evolve as a function of time. And you don't look at one water bubble. Remind you here, you have maybe 50,000 different water bubbles you then look at, because you collect a lot of data. So you can also do the statistical analysis. But here what was interesting was that you look here at here's the phase diagram, the hologram of the water bubble, and here's the reconstructed phase. Reconstructed phase is basically the electron density. The white part here is empty, so water bubble in the inner is empty. But then you see this part here is much blacker. And this is normal water. So this here is much blacker. I mean, it's much higher density. So the rim of the water bubble has a density that is 30% higher than normal water. Then the next question is then, what's in the structure of this water? Because water is actually difficult to compress. And that could be one of the next experiments to understand, is this a different phase of water, which only exists when the bubble is created? These are some of the experiments that will be hopefully be done in the in the next years. Secondly, you could also ask, if you had a femtosecond laser, what happens in the really beginning of the creation of the water bubble? But these are experiments to come. Now, Gila is not here. I showed this actually to him because this was a really Wigner Institute experiment, which was done, I forgot, a year ago or something like that. I was actually going to ask him, how is the publication going? But maybe some of you can transmit it to him. This was Kossel lines, a very nice fundamental experiment where you could see by a single shot measurements of the copper Kossel lines in gallium arsenide, single shot. So this was taken within 10 femtoseconds, and then we can start to dream about what kind of experiments, dynamic experiments, could you then actually do. So we were very pleased with this, and I think this also collected a lot of data. Here's another experiment which we did quite recently, actually, this spring here, with run by Felix Limkühle, where we looked at hydrate and the hydrate structures, which are you see them all over the world, and you need to understand what the structure actually is in these deposits of natural gas hydrates, which are all around the world. And this was also a proof of concept experiment, because we wanted to go into PDF, pair distribution function measurements. You can get structures of amorphous materials, and here we actually managed now to go up to 13 kV, 23 kV, and have a detector really close to the sample to get a up to 9 reciprocal angstroms, where you then can start to learn something about the structure of these hydrates. I cannot give you any results because this is really new. This is another example from FXC, where you look at the emission spectroscopy on antibacterial agents used for water purification. Now, I then go to the high energy density experiment, because we have had a really, really successful spring. The high energy density is an experiment where you pump your sample with a very powerful laser and then look at the structure afterwards. So it only exists in this excited state for maybe a nanosecond, then you look in and see what actually works. So you can do laser compression. You can look at diamond anvil cells, where you have a fast piezo to press on the diamond anvil cell, and then look at the structural changes. You can look at the relativistic laser plasmas. You can look here at isochoric X-ray excitation, and there's a lot of different things here. This is for high energy density, where the temperature is low, but the density is really high, so it depends how you drive the sample, what laser you use. And this here is where you drive the solid into extreme high temperatures, and then look at the structure there. So we have a number of it's a collaboration with the Dresden Rossendorf and others. We call it the HIPEM collaboration, where they have different possibilities for driving the sample here. And one is the diamond anvil cell, where you pulse them up. Also, the X-ray beam heats the sample. You have a very powerful optical lasers. You have the dipole laser, and you have the relax laser, the femtosecond laser here. And you have possibilities. We are not quite there yet, to look pulse magnetic fields up to 60 Tesla, where you look at the when you drive up your magnetic field, you come with the 2,700 pulses, and you look at the structure when you go up to 60 Tesla and come down again. So the kind of studies here is looking at planetary science, looking at the inner part of Jupiter, looking at the inner part of the Earth. And I was hoping that I would be allowed today to show results from a paper that is coming within the next weeks in Nature Astronomy. So we actually also publishing in Nature Astronomy, but that was unfortunately not possible. The other one here is the compression physics, where you look at the structures, where you, for instance, could look at aluminum. What happens if you really press it up into a new state that maybe have not been seen before? And I think there's a lot of really exciting science that we will do in the next couple of years, looking at matters under extreme condition and what are the structures under extremely high pressures. Because remember, these pressures only exist for maybe nanoseconds. This is not something you can study with neutrons or any other techniques. So here's the whole setup, where you have a relax laser, the dipole laser, and there's so much equipment around here, as you can see. But it really works, and I think you will see a lot of highly interested science coming out. And if some of you are working in this field, you can connect to the HIBEF consortium. Yeah, we just had the dipole experiment. Just to show you here, we had a week where we had more than 80 users on site. It was really exciting to see so many people. They were all over the place. We had four different science areas that was working, and the experiments could actually be done. Many of the experiments were done only in a few hours. So that was this was a really exciting week. As I said, we also work on magnetic studies. This morning at the university, we were discussing skirmions, and here we have actually been looking at the skirmions and the formation of skirmions. This was done at the SES instrument, where they really have done a lot of magnetic work. And we also here have holographic studies looking at ultrafast magnetic phenomena. As an advertising, I don't know whether people here are interested in photoemission spectroscopy. It's a typical solid state technique. This here is a new instrument which is provided by a German collaboration. So we provide the port. They come with the instruments, and then you can do experiments on it. It's starting now, and if you have other ideas for photoemission spectroscopy, or you want to come with your own equipment and use software X-rays, this is actually a possibility. And these are hopefully data that we are going to see coming out very, very soon. This is not from our instrument. So a little bit to the end here, the user community, a typical experiment takes 3 to 5 days. We do 100 experiments per year. We hope to go up to 200 experiments per year by making them shorter when things go better. And typical user groups, you can see the size here is typically maybe 10 to 20 people, although some of them are more than 50 people. But then it's for special experiments and the one I just showed. How could you get involved? Well, you can ask. I call him George. I just learned that's another name, but he will then for sure find the right people. You can also contact me. We could make, you can join our users meeting in January. We thinking about making joint summer schools or joint workshops on particular topics. I mean, it could be topics which could involve not only Flexon lasers, but also the synchron relation or neutrons, where you know, certain topics about energy or environment or whatever. We also have joint PhD students with many of our shareholder countries, where they partly paid by Exfil, partly paid by the shareholder countries. And then we have a special thing here that we can apply for screening beam time, in particular for at SPB, where you can come in and try to do an experiment for a few hours and see if things actually work. So we're very open to get new users in. And here's the campus, if you haven't been there. So we have the main building. The experiments are being done in the experimental hall down here. We have a guest house, so you can stay on site. We have 59 beds. We have a restaurant here. We have a new office building, and we will soon have a visitor center where we can also host conferences, etc. We're a little bit limited in our lecture room capabilities. What are the next years to come? So what are the directions we want to pursue? We are in particular interested in see whether it can do lasing at 70 to 100 kV. There we need to start a superconducting undulator program and a new detector program, and we're working into the attosecond time regime, and there might be collaboration possibilities with Eli. And with that, I would say thank you very much for your attention. You can see here, there's probably a few Hungarians missing. We could take up a few if somebody would be interested to join the staff, maybe also on sabbaticals. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Are there questions? Online questions? Anybody would like to ask something?
I can tell you yesterday, the biology people were really active and asking a lot of questions. And I would be disappointed if the physicists do not have questions.
Who will pick up the challenge? So. Okay, Robert is open to questions after the seminar also, if you are shy to ask openly. And let me take the opportunity. Okay, first of all, and then everybody can have questions. Yes, that's a small present. First of all, this is
thank you very much.
This is open, please.
Ah, yeah.
It's a certified Wigner watch.
Thank you very much.
Explain what you see on the portrait. And
thank you.
It was not in the bag because of the rain, so I transported in separate bag, but two bottles.
Ah, yeah, this is going to be tricky to get home with energy.
One of the best red wines of Hungary.
Thank you very much.
So thank you for coming, Robert. So questions. Ah, great.
Finally, yes.
Wait.
Zhukovsky, Constantine, I'm quite new to Wigner. I worked in Frascati in Spark facility. Facility, and I work in theory there. I have a question: if there is a room for any kind of a sort of theory work at the XPEL with you, because I would like to move to you.
Absolutely, we have a theory group which is actually organized by Alexander Lichtenstein from Hamburg University. We have a couple of people working there. And I can tell you one of the successes. I didn't show any of the data there today, but that is by Russell and Korta, where they look at the correlation, angular correlation in the data, where you look at the scattering data, and then he have developed methods to actually look at the angular correlations to get much more information out than you do, for instance, in a small angle scattering picture. Now, if you have a small angle scattering picture, you see these. I always say small angle scattering is you measure curves that look like this here, right? They all look like this, and then you really detail, you know, fit them, and you know maybe a little bit there, but basically it doesn't contain much information. If you only have a few particles in a small angle scattering, you average so many particles. If you only have a few particles, you get speckle, you get interference pattern, and then you can start to analyze that and get much more information out of the shape of these particles. And this is what as an example, what Rosland actually did, and it's now a tool that is being used in many experiments. But we also have collaborations where we looked on more solid state dynamic solid state phenomena. For instance, magnetic transitions or electron spectroscopy. So there is opportunities there, and the person to contact. I don't know if you know Alexander Lichtenstein, but that's in him. They also have a EU Synodic grant. He's one of him and Olle in Uppsala. I forgot his last name, and a person in Nijmegen. So there is a big group there to work on, yeah. Yes. Do you know him?
No.
Yeah, okay, but yeah.
My question is concerned to the samples. Are there sample preparation utilities or services? Yeah. This is one question to the samples. The other is that at the neutron or normal X-ray synchrotron facilities, we are used to have a rather heavy sample conditioning systems. Yeah. So how does it work in the case of single shot experiments?
Well, first of all, there are experiments, but they're not single shot. So you can actually look at your sample for longer times, but you really need to be very careful. Typically, an experiment will then start with that you have a let's say, call it a dummy sample, and then you look where is the radiation damage threshold. Because if you get too much beam on you all the dynamics you would see is then dominated by radiation damage. But we have in particular for structural biology, we have a huge lab, 500 square meters, where people can come in weeks before to crystallize sample, to analyze, to test their sample. We also have a sample laboratory for solid samples, also for the, in a solid sample, typically you would then need to look at different positions on your sample. So you basically have to scan very, very fast. We, for instance, had experiments where you look on melting. So you have a foil and then you hit it with a laser and then the sample melts and then you look at it with the X-ray beam. But then, of course, afterwards, there's a hole. So then you need to scan the sample very fast. For the high pressure work, these diamond envin cells on the high pressure, they sometimes only last one shot. So you have people there pressing these diamond cells, and then you put them in, and So we have a high sample consumption, and therefore we need to have auxiliary laboratory that can support that. So if you have ideas, I mean, you can talk what is actually available. Yeah. Also characterization with X-ray single crystal diffractometer, powder diffractometers, and all that, various microscopes.
Okay, I don't see any more questions online, neither. Ah, there is a question.
I have a question for the particular success rate of the experiments in all other words out of the 100 user campaigns. How many of the generate publishable
result? That is a very good question, because typically we have been looking at the publication output of the facility. We've been operating for 5 years. In the first couple of years, there were not so many experiments being done. But I looked at the first thing. We have 50 or 60 publications in total, and typically there's a delay between experiment publication between 2 to 3 years. So therefore, it's a little bit difficult to see. In a couple of years, we would know much better. And I would expect that every publication gives at least, one publication. Every experiment should give, on average, one publication. I know from other facilities, I talk with Fermi at in Trieste, they have these successful experiments, they say, give maybe 2 to 3 publications, and the unsuccessful, none. So you cannot expect a publication from every experiment, but the really good ones, you could expect more than one. And I think about one on average would be okay.
Balázs Farkas who asked the question. No more? Okay, then. Thank you, Robert, again.
Thank you very much.
It was great that you have been here. Anybody is welcome to stay from consultation with Robert if you